Good morning. I call the House Community and Regional Affairs meeting to order. Today is Thursday, March 12th at 8:05 a.m. Members present are Representative Kai Holland, Representative Garrett Nelson, Representative Steve St. Clair, Representative Carolyn Hall, Co-Chair Representative Rebecca Hemshute, and myself, Co-Chair Donna Mears. We have a quorum to conduct business. Just a reminder for first thing in the morning, please silence your cell phones. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my aide, Talia Ames, and thanks to Co-Chair Hemshute's committee aide, Thatcher Brower. Before we get started, I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Sophia Tenney, and helping us from the Juno LIO is Kyla Tupo. So on today's agenda, we've got four bills. First off, we will bring up HB 155 Alcohol Sales Local Option, sponsored by Representative Foster. This is the bill's third hearing. Next, we'll hold public testimony for HB 286, Firefighters EMS Property Tax Exemption, sponsored by Representative Elam, and this is the bill's second hearing. Third, we'll have bill introduction and invited testimony for HB 234, PERS Emergency Dispatchers, sponsored by Representative Hall, and this is the bill's first hearing, and then also a first hearing for House Bill 309, Jonesville Public Use Area, sponsored by Representative Garrett Nelson. So first, we'll take up House Bill 155. Our intention is to move the bill today, and we received no amendments. Mr. LeBoll, do you have any final comments on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul LeBoll, staff to Representative Foster. Thank you for your time. I'm available for questions.
Are there any final questions from the committee? Excellent. Co-Chair Hemshute, you got something for us?
Yes, I'd like to make a motion. I move to report HB 155-34-LS0773-A out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note and authorize legislative legal services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 155-34-LS0773-A moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. LeBoll, and thank you, committee. That passes with no objection. With individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We're going to take a brief at ease to sign the committee report. We are back on the record in House Community Affairs. Next, we will take up House Bill 286 for public testimony. Representative Elam and staff, welcome to the committee. Please approach the testifier, put yourself on record, and give us a quick update on your bill. Reminder, recap.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you, chairs, members of the committee. Appreciate the second hearing on the bill. It's a tax exemption for volunteer firefighters and EMS, just kind of a quick little highlight. And so in essence, it gives the municipalities, the local property taxing authorities, the ability to be able to create a tax exemption that they feel is adequate for recruiting, you know, volunteer firefighters specifically in their areas and in their communities. Currently, there is a $10,000 cap, and it's managed by statute. And so this bill simply removes that and says that they can do, at the local level, whatever they feel is necessary.
Thank you very much. And before I open up to questions, welcome Representative Prox, who joined us about 10 after. So do we have questions from the committee before we go to testimony? Representative Holland.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. I'm just reviewing my notes from when we looked at this bill, I guess a week and a half or two ago. It doesn't matter exactly when. I know there were some questions and a little discussion about how the certification standards would be set, and I understand that each department can set some standards. And I think the discussion was around how do we establish some or view the control around just how many volunteers who might volunteer informally might be able to get swept up into this sort of exemption. And I'm just wondering if there was any more discussion or any more thoughts following that discussion last time about how should we think about this in terms of ensuring that the way this is structured, that this is really going to provide this benefit for those folks that are truly stepping up and volunteering in a significant way to generate this kind of benefit, so that it's rewarding that effort, as opposed to, I just was a little curious about if this could create everybody's a volunteer firefighter.
Through the chair. Thank you for the question. We did do some follow-up conversations. The majority of my conversations happened with a variety of the fire chiefs whenever they were in town. And then I also had a couple of other follow-up conversations with folks on the Kenai Peninsula, because the way it's been structured thus far is it's really deferred to local control. Very much, you know, we have done that as a state with many of our systems. And this is one of those times. Because of the certification requirements and the rigors that go with maintaining those certifications, that's going to be the biggest thing that keeps, you know, everybody from being an overnight volunteer. That said, there is limited controls at a state level currently, and this statute doesn't get modified to make those rigors any more rigorous than what is currently in place. And so... we could look at those areas, but the municipalities right now are motivated to manage that, because it would be in their best interest to make sure that that's not happening, and they're also the local taxing authority. So I prefer to give municipalities the ability to manage that. I think they probably do the best job at it personally.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we do also have online two folks to help answer questions. We have Dan Nelson, the state assessor with Division of Community and Regional Affairs with DCCED, and Sandra Moeller, who is the director of Community and Regional Affairs with DCCED. Are there any further questions from the committee before we take our probably very short public testimony? Seeing and hearing none, we will go to public testimony. I will now open public testimony for House Bill 286. Is there anyone in the room here for public testimony? Seeing and hearing none, I will go to the line. Seeing no one on the line, I will now close public testimony. Promised it would be short. So seeing no one else to testify, we will set the bill aside for... Oh, we got another question. The public testimony aroused some questions within Representative Prox.
Yeah,
Representative Prox.
The public testimony reminded me that... I don't necessarily agree with them, but that's not my job. Municipalities should just be given... if they can exempt someone, they can exempt whoever they choose, as far as I'm concerned. And I think we should amend the bill to just give them broad authority, just give the authority to them. They can figure out what they want to do for standards and et cetera. Is there any interest in working on that together?
Representative Prox, I believe that's how that works. So the municipality is the one that are really making the decisions on who is eligible for the tax exemption. Is that right? What you're...
No, I'm thinking, you know, why limit it to firefighters? There's lots of other volunteers.
Representative Colom has a bill that is very much down that line.
Right. Are we going to be hearing that anytime soon?
We are working on that. Yes, that bill's got a lot to it, and we're very interested in making space and time to hear that and consider that. It's a big change.
Yes.
It's a big change, and we need, we're going to need some time to make sure that we get the word out to local municipalities to have that impact. And we do have, on this bill, we have support from the Kenai Peninsula Borough as promised. So we will we are working with Representative Coulomb's office to bring back HB 291 and have a broader discussion about optional property tax exemptions. But today, in front of us, are there any further questions for Representative Elam? Seeing none, we will set a amendment deadline for HB 286 for Tuesday, March 17th at 5 p.m. So that's next week. If you are looking at an amendment, please let us know. And if you need any more time than that, otherwise we will set the bill aside for now. Thank you, Representative Elam.
Thank you.
Next up, Representative Hall. We will hear House Bill 234. Please welcome to the committee. Please approach the table, put yourself on the record, and proceed with your bill presentation.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chairs. Good morning, Community and Regional Affairs Committee. Thank you very much for this opportunity to present House Bill 234. My name is Carolyn Hall, and I represent HD 16, which is West Anchorage, the Anchorage neighborhoods of Turning and Spinard and Sand Lake. The genesis of this bill started in the fall of 2024, where I was a participant in the Anchorage Fire Department's Fire Ops 101 course. And throughout that day of learning what it takes to be a firefighter, a paramedic, EMT, I discovered through conversations that this is an issue. And the issue is emergency response dispatchers are treated differently than their peace officer and firefighter first responder colleagues. And they're treated differently in the way that they don't have the same access to the retirement benefits that their first responder colleagues do. And the reason for that will be explained in the presentation as far as the course of the history of dispatching and all that has evolved over the last 50 or so years. So the problem is that Emergency response dispatchers they're often called the first responders. They pick up the phone and they answer our calls when we're under complete duress and oftentimes having the worst experience of our lives. I had that experience last fall, actually, where I had to call 911 to report a dangerous driver. And what these dispatchers do is they calmly get the information that they need to best serve us and help us in our time of most need. And they relay that information to the first responders who are actually out in the field. And additionally to just locating us and telling the first responders where to go, they also provide life-saving skills, life-saving information. If I need to perform CPR on someone, they're telling me how to do that. If I have to, if I'm in a position where I'm helping to deliver a baby, I don't know how to do that. The emergency response dispatcher is telling me what to do. And frankly, they save lives. They also experience, because they're constantly on this rotation of picking up phones when people are in most need, they oftentimes don't have the opportunity for closure. And so what happens is they just move on to the next emergency, and they don't get to have the, satisfaction or fulfillment of knowing how things turned out. So there's a lot of stress that comes with the work that they perform. It's a very skilled job that they perform, and they deserve to have the same retirement benefits that their first responder colleagues have. And we'll get into what those benefits are during the bill presentation. But currently at the federal level, emergency response dispatchers are classified as clerical instead of the classification of protective service occupations. And so that means that these first responders, these dispatchers, are not allowed access to federal grants, federal training, and similar resources that their first responder colleagues are able to have access to. So it's kind of a two-pronged thing, what is going on here when it comes to the state level and the federal level. And another piece of legislation that I've sponsored addresses more or less actions that the federal government can take. But this bill in front of us is specific to ensuring that first responders have access to those necessary retirement benefits. So with that, Madam Co-Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my staff for greater and perhaps stronger and better articulated bill introduction.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Maya Nara. I'm staff to Representative Hall. Madam Chair, would you like me to do the sectional, or should I do the sectional in my presentation? Should I just jump into my presentation?
Please do.
Okay, thank you. So some brief overarching history of emergency dispatch. So the first actual 911 call was in 1968 in Haleyville, Alabama, and I thought it was fun that the second 911 call happened 6 days later in Nome, Alaska. So that's sort of just a fun little fact. In 1975, so between this time, 68 to 75, most dispatchers were actually being filled more and more by civilian roles, as more of our police and firefighters and paramedics were being pulled into the field. They needed someone to take that job over. These dispatchers that were only required to communicate clearly, be able to work the microphone and the radio, and possess knowledge of street names and locations. And they were just mostly communicating with our first responders in the field on where to go and what the situation was. Today, our dispatchers have gone through a lot of changes. The first formal training program was established in 1979, and the term medical dispatcher took root. That was sort of the beginning of the transition from just location names and where we are to actually providing that life-saving information that they provide today. In the 80s, the job scope continued to expand. They were doing pre-arrival instructions for major calls, including CPR, choking, childbirth, and some of the other things we mentioned earlier. Then in 1989, the medical community put out some papers, and in those papers, they were establishing that this standard of having these pre-scripted or pre-arrival instructions was a mandatory component of every medical dispatch center, and that it was safe and effective and necessary work as part of our first responder system. So this bill does three things. It adds language and statute that defines emergency medical dispatchers as first responders trained as public safety telecommunicators. I know that's wordy. And also in sections 2 and 3 of the bill, it adds language into the definitions that are used for PERS under the definition of peace officers or firefighters to include specifically our dispatchers. I believe it says in the bill that dispatchers who work for police and fire departments or in state trooper offices. So these dispatchers who are providing emergency medical response are going to be included in that peace officer definition. And then it sets the effective date for July. So what actually changes. So you can see on the left here, currently in the PERS defined benefit plan for Tier 3 members, this is currently what our dispatchers are receiving. We are part of the all others category, where employees are contributing 6.75%. This change would be that police and fire contribute 7.5%, so they would be, employees would be contributing a little bit more by 0.75%. There would be the change in retirement. So all other members after vesting retirement is at 60 years old. Early retirement is 55. And if you have 30 years of service, you can retire at any age. Police and fire can retire at any age after they've done 20 years of service. I do want to just make a note that our youngest people who would be in Tier 3 would have be reaching their normal retirement age and their 30 years of service in 2030. So we're talking really about a very small group of people who are still operating in Plan Tier 3 for dispatchers. And then the benefit calculation for their pensions is changes from being averaged on a high consecutive 5 years to a high consecutive 3 years. For our tier four members, the contribution rate does not change. What does change is that police and firefighters are exempt from early withdrawal penalties if they retire or separate at age 50 or have at least 25 years of service. Right now, taxes and penalties may apply if they withdraw before they're 59 and a half years old. And then lastly, access to medical coverage, which would change to any age if they have 25 years of service instead of at the Medicare eligible age of 65 with 10 years of service or 30 years of service. And with that, I can take questions.
Thank you very much. You want to do questions now or do you invite invited testimony?
Invited testimony, please.
Okay, let's start with our invited testimony. We have a few folks on the line today. First off, Matthew Carlson. He's a firefighter and paramedic with the Anchorage Fire Department. Are you online and ready to testify? If so, please put yourself on the record and begin. Good morning.
Sorry, good morning. Thank you all for giving me the opportunity. My name is Matthew Carlson. I am a firefighter paramedic for the Anchorage Fire Department and an executive board member for the Anchorage Firefighters Local 1264. As a firefighter paramedic on the busiest ambulance in the state, I can wholeheartedly attest to what our dispatchers do and the need for reclassification into a first responder status. I'm here to provide a little bit of background. At least in Anchorage, once the 911 caller is transferred from the Anchorage Police Department dispatch to the Anchorage Fire Department dispatch, our fire and EMS dispatchers are immediately triaged to determine the severity of the call and how many resources need to be sent. Within the first minute, our dispatchers have obtained an address and have landed on chief complaint like chest pain, shortness of breath, stroke, trauma, abdominal pain, et cetera, and are immediately dispatching the correct units. While the ambulances and the fire trucks are on the way, the dispatchers are still gathering information, signs of symptoms, pertinent medical history, medications, and then are immediately rolling into pre-arrival instructions like bystander CPR, Heimlich maneuvers, baby deliveries, structured fire instructions. Our dispatchers go through rigorous training in fire and EMS when they are hired. I teach a 25-hour EMS course during the dispatch academy. I essentially teach an EMT class so our dispatchers are able to recognize, triage, and treat a wide variety of medical and psychological illnesses. Our dispatchers are very aggressive and effective when it comes to bystander CPR. Our out-of-hospital cardiac arrest save rate in Anchorage is typically one of the highest performers in the country and are usually about 30% higher than the national average, which can be attributed to how efficient our dispatchers are at catching and treating cardiac arrests. After the EMS portion of the academy that I teach, a fire captain then teaches new dispatchers how to manage structured fires, wildland fires, motor vehicle accidents, and hazardous material incidents. About 25 states so far have changed their classification to recognize dispatchers as first responders. This allows for more grant opportunities, mental health support, retirement benefits, and award recognition. These states have taken the first step to recognize dispatchers for the work we do, and I am urging Alaska to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Coach O'Hemshoot has got a question for you.
Thank you. It was Mr. Carlson, right?
Yep.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Carlson, I need help understanding how this works. I come from a very small town. So a dispatcher right now, what is the minimum qualification to be a dispatcher? Does a dispatcher go through paramedic training and then dispatcher is a next level up? Or dispatcher is kind of entry level and then they go through additional training? Because it seems like there's like a script they follow, but you know, if you suspect someone's heart has stopped and you're talking someone through how to do CPR, I mean, sure, there's probably a script, but you're making a lot of judgment calls right there. So, how does someone become a dispatcher?
Yeah, great question. It's going to depend on each agency on how they do it, and depending on if it's a police dispatching center or a fire and EMS dispatching center, a lot of our dispatch centers are together. In Anchorage, it's special because there's a police side and there's a fire and EMS side. Specifically on our side, and maybe Steph can talk to it a little bit more, but our dispatchers are hired with some experience in either like data or the exact verbiage of it, but essentially you don't have to necessarily have EMS or fire experience, or you don't have to be an EMT or a paramedic when you're hired as a dispatcher. Our dispatchers, once they are hired, are encouraged to get their EMT certification, but it's not a requirement. They essentially go through the class that I teach, which gives them the overview of how to recognize strokes and abdominal pain and chest pain and how to give those instructions. They do have scripts that they follow, but they're encouraged to, you know, think critically and dispatch as they feel appropriately.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we will go to Stephanie Wolf, who's the lead dispatcher for Anchorage Fire Department, who I think might have more detailed information on that process.
Thank you. I can explain that. Hi, I can explain that detail at the end. After my testimony, I'll be more than happy to explain the hiring as long as time allows.
Thank you. Please put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Wolf, and I'm a lead dispatcher for the Anchorage Fire Department, and I thank you for allowing me to provide my testimony today to support HB 234. Representative Hall did an excellent job describing some of the history, so I might touch on some of the same points. As we know, before 911 was established, pretty much you either called your operator, law enforcement, or your local fire department, and they sent help. First 911 call was in Alabama in 1968. At that time, either you answered a phone or you hit a switchboard, and then you sent law enforcement or the right agency to the call, hung up the phone, and then went on to the next task. One significant event was in 1974. That's when the first pre-arrival instruction was provided when a mom called about her drowned child, and they walked her through CPR. In my opinion, we went from 911 operators to public safety telecommunicators because we were able to provide life-saving instructions over the phone while responders were en route. This, in my opinion, was when we became an integral part of the emergency response system. In 1988, emergency medical dispatch use of pre-arrival instructions is now the standard recommendation from the National Association of Emergency Management of Emergency Medical Physicians. On any given day, we are expected to deliver the following types of pre-arrival instructions to bystanders and patients. And keep in mind, this script that we have has to be approved by our medical director. Scene safety, CPR, childbirth, AED admin, choking, sinking vehicles, person on fire, trapped in a structure fire, burns, bleeding instructions, but can be tourniquets, seizures, diabetic crisis, allergic reactions, avalanche safety, mudslides, structure collapses, swift water rescue, electrical hazards, hazmat gas leaks, train incidents, water rescues, mental health problems, front country rescues, industrial entrapments, and that's just a few. Alaska has 22 public safety answering points, and we take over 372,000 911 calls annually. At the Anchorage Fire Department, the public safety telecommunicators, we are state emergency medical certified and sponsored by Dr. Levy as our medical director. We have a two-week academy that firefighter paramedic Carlson talked about, which trains us on how to use our intranet. They train us on how to use the medical side, fire terminology, behavior, and also with 32 hours sick or not sick class so we can make educated decisions. We also in the academy talk to our dispatchers and show them how to use our 911 phone system, understand how 911 plots and behaves, how this information integrates into our computer-aided dispatch system, how to use that system, understand how our radio works in the city as well as the state, how to manage those systems, and how to put it all together. It takes a couple years to put things all together to become proficient using the systems. During this whole entire time, we are engaging with the caller, making quick decisions, multitasking, fully knowing that one wrong keystroke or decision can impact our lives. We have evolved from phone operators to resource allocators, logistic coordinators, and lifesavers, and reclassifying us as first responders acknowledges the work. As Matt said, 325 states have already reclassified us as first responders, and I respectfully request us to become the next state in the union. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Did you want to go into the training bits a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually have a current posting there. So, I'm sorry, does somebody have a question?
No, just getting back to Coach Hipshoot.
Okay. So I can speak for my specific agency. I don't know how other agencies train, because other agencies, and Dennis, who's going to speak later, can speak to how APD, the Anchorage Police Department, trains their dispatchers as well. So what we do is we have an actual official academy. So to be a dispatcher, you go through the application process. You're required to have a GED or a high school diploma. Yes, it's considered an entry-level position to a point, and you move up from there. However, we don't make entry-level decisions. We take, as me, I came from a grocery store, so I was very, very scared. But the training that they have is, well, it's well done. You're trained by a paramedic. They teach you what makes you sick or not sick. You have to go through a whole course, as well as explaining fire terminology. It takes time when you're sitting, once you're done going through this academy and understanding that process, you actually have an on-the-job trainer that sits with you almost up to a year. You have a year to go through this program to understand how to use the systems proficiently, because you're not just taking the knowledge from the medical fire side. You actually have to apply it as a live 911 caller calls you, and you're trying to navigate and go through and drive the system. That's when it gets hard, and you have to multitask the 911 caller as well as somebody on a tactical channel talking to you on a totally different situation, because that's what we're required to do. Even though it's entry level, we say it takes about 3 years to become proficient. And that's why it takes 3 years for you to get promoted. If you want to become a lead dispatcher, which is what I am, you have to have at least 3 years in the job to be able to get promoted into a supervisor role in the center.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Any further questions at the moment? Representative Hall, then Representative Prox.
Great.
Holland. You're both in my line of vision here.
We're good. Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Wolf. I'm curious, from your experience and you know, working with your colleagues, what's the situation in terms of how long people typically stay in dispatcher roles as they move through? I understand to some degree, you know, that this is extremely stressful. It must be incredibly hard to move into these situations and be handling this work. And I'm just curious, do folks do this for some years, and then is there a career progression that you typically see people moving into, or do they stay in this position for, you know, until retirement? What's the typical career pathway for somebody, and how long is that?
That's a good question. The first, a lot of times we'll lose half of our probationary employees in the probationary period. Because, as you know, sometimes we ask people to sit in dispatch before you take the job. We want you to sit in for a few hours, because a lot of people haven't even been in there, so they don't know what to expect. You watch it on TV and you think, oh, that's what it is. And when you sit in there into the controlled chaos, it's a lot different. Most of our people we are very lucky. We have people that are ranging for 25 years to people that we just hired. The progression in our area is either up to a lead position, and I've seen people go to like the fire inspector side, but most of our people will stay. I don't know if anybody since I've been there for the 20 year, or 18 years that I've been there that have stayed 30 years, because it's just too much on the body, right? You're sitting down for 12 hours a day, which is, we know, is dangerous physically, and then taking the 12 hours to 18 hour shifts we might have to work. It's very hard on the body. We have three different generations of people that work with different viewpoints on work-life balance. Sometimes that's even hard to recruit people, knowing, oh, you mean I have to work over, or I have to work so many days in a row and then get so many days off? Some people don't want that, because a lot of people can work from home. So sometimes you're kind of, you know, we have a good benefits and we have good medical right now. It's sometimes hard to recruit people to get them to stay, because there's anymore you have different age groups where working that many years or that many hours a day is just not as appeasing. So they'll quit and do a whole new career path. But so far we have people that have stayed up to 25 years.
Okay, that's good for now. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, I think you might have answered the first question on a person has to have an aptitude for that job. And I think you said you just let them give it a go for a while and see if. And I'm not sure there's a better way to do it, but is there something else that's for screening people?
And I, you know, when I did it, and I did, I apologize for what I forgot to mention, is that we do a pre-screening, which is like, we call it critical. Mm-hmm. So, hey, I want to be a dispatcher. So you put in the application, and if you're accepted through our human resources department, they'll put you to the next step. And the next step are specific aptitude tests for the job. So we'll send you a link. You go on this computer program, and you simulate parts of a job. So reading maps, you'll have to understand how to do multitasking, which is the biggest part of the job. So you'll be doing something. Something might pop up, and you'll have to acknowledge that. And they'll kind of give you a little stress test and score you from that, and then they bring you for another interview, and you have two interviews after that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess second, are you represented by a labor union? Are you in the same union as the firefighters, or is there a different?
We are. So we are very fortunate enough at the Anchorage Fire Department, I can speak for us, we're part of the International Association of Firefighters Union, and we are part of their contract binding agreement.
And third follow-up,
Representative Prox.
Does the union, or is there some other organization outside of the city or the state that, if you will, sets standards?
We do. We have multiple ones. So one of them is called APCO, which is the Association of Public Safety Communication Officials. And there's another one called NENA, National Emergency Numbers Association. And both organizations have been around for one of them over 100 years, and they help with advocating and also legislation on a state and federal level. And I'm actually the second vice president of our Alaska APCO chapter. And we come together, we talk. I mean, it's not like we just sit there and hang out and talk. We talk about, like, at the state ones, we talk about state problems, like GIS, like addressing radio problems in the rural areas, a training, scholarships, and how to get people at conferences outside of our state. And we try to get people organized in our state, and one of the big things we're trying to organize now is the first responder one, and also radio, and getting our new NG911 infrastructure set up with a BEAD grant is one of our next things we're trying to push as well.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Final follow-up?
Final follow-up, yes.
Representative Prox.
On the sponsor statement, second paragraph mentions federal standard occupational classification. Is that something that needs to be addressed if there is a federal standard for the occupation? Because that gets into workers' comp and insurance calculations and all that.
I'm not sure how that. So the federal side to make us protective workers, all it does, it's a zero fiscal note. It takes us from the clerical side to the protective worker side, which opens up grants federally. And also, there's a lot of places, like we're lucky to be part of a union. There's a lot of areas where I've spoken to a dispatcher from Skagway, and there's only one dispatcher there, and I asked her, like, how do you go to the bathroom? She goes, well, there's a phone in there. So that gives you staffing protection as well. So that's what the protective worker does. I'm not sure if it does anything with insurance.
Uh-huh. But there is a federal standard. Does that federal standard need to be addressed in order to accomplish this?
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the Co-Chair, Representative Prox, there is federal legislation that is being considered right now, a couple pieces actually, where the where this would be addressed. So right now, according to the federal government, under the federal standard occupational classification system, emergency response dispatchers are listed as essentially clerical workers, along with all the other types of dispatchers, like cab dispatchers, for example. And so what the federal government is considering right now, Congress is considering, is reclassifying emergency response dispatchers into the protective service occupation category, which is the same category as police, fire, and other first responders. And so what I mentioned during my opening remarks, there's another piece of legislation that our office is working on, and that's HJR 38, which encourages Congress to not only consider but also pass this classification at the federal level to allow these emergency response dispatchers nationwide to have access to federal grants and other federal benefits that their fellow first responders are allowed and have access to.
Thank you. Coach Hemshoot?
Yeah, I think my question is better for a different testifier, but I do have a question for the bill sponsor on the presentation. On the same lines of questioning, it says for the TERS differentiations, I'm sorry, PERS differentiations, it says police fire. Are paramedics considered fire?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, I believe that is the case, but I might want to defer to DRB or to Matthew Carlson just to put a fine point on that.
To work with dispatchers is one thing if we haven't also already addressed paramedics. I just want to confirm that. Thank you.
So did you want to confirm that with DRB?
Yes, please.
So we do have on the line Brandon Roomsburg. He's the retirement manager for the Division of Retirement and Benefits with Department of Administration. Mr. Roomsburg, thank you for joining us. Do you need that question again, or are you prepared to answer it right off the bat?
Good morning. Thank you for having me here. If you could please restate the question, that would help.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, my question is, are paramedics classified as fire? We're talking about dispatchers today, but I just want to confirm that we've already had a conversation at some point previously that if you are a paramedic, you are considered police or fire, one or the other.
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, to answer the question, that would be a classification question with the employer. As long as they're classifying them as firefighters, then yes, they would be reported under the P and F occupation code within the system.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
So through the co-chair, I want to confirm then it's locally determined, so there isn't going to be a state DRB official saying this person, this paramedic does not have specific fire training and therefore they're not qualified. It's 100% locally determined?
Through the chair, DRB does not take the stance of defining the position, so we do not get involved in how the employer classifies those positions. We just look to evaluate that they are fitting within the definitions provided with the PERS. And for a quick reference, a firefighter is defined in state statute as a firefighter, a fire, or a fire chief. The definition can be found in AS 3935680, number 30.
Okay, thank you. Well, actually, I have another question for this gentleman.
Yes,
sorry,
please.
Through the co-chair, one of my questions, and maybe the bill sponsor knows this, but since we have you on the line, you may not be able to answer this because the change has not been made yet, how many people we're talking about. So maybe the bill sponsor knows this. Sorry, I'm jumping all around here. I just want to know how many people would be covered by this legislation. Maybe, Mr. Roomsburg, you probably don't know it because we haven't made the change yet, correct?
Through the chair, that would be correct.
Okay, so to the bill sponsor.
Thank you, Representative Hemshoot. Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, we are working to track down that information. It's been rather tedious to find that information, but I would like to kick it over to my staff, Maya Narong, because she's done more work on this and can provide a little bit more nuance to your question.
For the record, Maya Narong, Staff Representative Hall, through the chair, Chair Hemshoot. So our office is currently trying to track this information down, and when I have it, I will share it with the committee. We have been sent now, I think, to three, four places to try to track this information down. Every department says that this is under another department. So as soon as I have that, I will give that split of how many people this affects, how many are in Tier 3, and how many are in Tier 4.
Okay. I have more questions for the bill sponsor, but do you want to finish invited?
Finish our invited testimony. Okay. So we also have on the line Representative Hall.
Excuse me, Madam Co-Chair. I just wanted to share just a little bit of context for helping to answer Representative Hemshoot's question. And so the last day somebody could be part of the Tier 3 PERS was June 30th of 2006, and that would have been for an 18-year-old individual, which means that person, in this particular hypothetical, that person would have been born on June 30th of 1988 in order for them to be able to enroll in PERS Tier 3 at their soonest moment. When you add 30 years to that, that person would be eligible for a normal retirement on June 30th of 2030. Only leaving 4 years of participation in the peace officer occupation. And so there is a limited, because of the timing of when someone is born, when they get into Tier 3, and when they retire out, we're talking about a limited pool of Tier 3 people who would potentially be eligible.
But your bill makes adjustments in Tier 4 as well.
It does, yes.
So that's the question.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. I was having a hard time remembering what that date was when we went into Tier 4, and then I realized my son was born in July of 2006, and he will be 20 this summer. So we will go on to our next invited testimony. We've been on the fire, and now let's go to the police end. We've got Matthew Carlson. Nope. I'm sorry. Dennis Lasley. I'm jumping around on my list here. Police dispatch supervisor from the Anchorage Police Department and Police Association. Please put yourself on the record with your proper name and please provide your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Dennis Lasley. I currently serve as the vice president of the Anchorage Police Department's Employees Association, the APDEA. Representing the dedicated professionals who serve in Alaska's largest law enforcement agency. I am also a 911 dispatch supervisor, and I have more than 17 years of experience in public safety communications. Testifying today in support of HB 234, which recognizes our emergency dispatchers as initial first responders within Alaska's public safety system. Now, when someone calls 911, the first professional that they encounter, it is not a police officer, it is not a firefighter, it is not a paramedic, it is one of our dispatchers. In Anchorage, our emergency dispatchers, we work 12-hour shifts, often managing multiple life-threatening incidences simultaneously. During a single shift, it is not uncommon, unfortunately, for dispatchers to have to coordinate responses to shootings, to suicides, to overdoses, domestic violence incidences, structure fires, cardiac arrests, parking problems, snow-related disputes, and sometimes all of that within the same hour. As you can see, it is a roller coaster of emotions that our dispatchers, our call takers, have to handle and have to deal with. We're responsible for gathering the critical information and coordinating with our field responders. We provide life-saving medical instructions before help can even get there. We routinely guide these callers through CPR, choking emergencies, severe bleeding, or other critical interventions. In the first moments of an emergency, the dispatcher is often the only trained professional that is present, making them that first link in that chain of survival. However, the public often does not see this other side of work. Emergency dispatchers experience repeated exposure to trauma through the calls that they handle every day. We hear people during the worst moments of their lives. Parents begging for help for their children, victims hiding from abusers and domestic violence incidences, attempting to administer CPR instructions to someone who is frantic as someone is potentially dying in front of them. This constant exposure creates what's known as vicarious trauma. It's a psychological impact of experiencing traumatic events indirectly through others. Unlike our responders out in the field, dispatchers frequently experience that trauma without closure. We may spend seconds or minutes guiding someone through a life and death emergency, only for us to terminate that call and answer the next 911 that's in queue. It's not uncommon for us to ever learn of the outcome of that incident. This cumulative impact of work is significant. Across the country, emergency communication centers, we face serious challenges with burnout, with recruitment issues, and long-term retention. Specifically, as far as Anchorage goes, since 1990, we have seen less than 5 employees reach 30 years of service as 911 dispatchers. If we compare that to our law enforcement and our fire EMS professionals, While I don't have those specific numbers, I know we can all guarantee that they're significantly higher in respect to. While many enter this profession committed to a long career in public safety, this sustained exposure to trauma, high operational demands, and emotional toll of the work make the length of the service incredibly difficult to achieve. In addition to my role as a 911 supervisor, I also have volunteered more than 16 years as the lead volunteer for the Alaska chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Through this work, we work towards advocating for stronger mental health awareness, suicide prevention efforts, and better supporting the support systems for those that respond to these crises every day. That experience has reinforced something many in public safety already understand, and that's that the mental and emotional demands placed on those that answer these calls are substantial. And recognizing their role is an important step towards supporting the workforce that continues for these communities that they demand and depend on. HB 234 acknowledges a reality that already exists in practice, and that's that every dispatcher, we're not simply call takers. We are trained professionals. We provide critical first interventions during emergencies, and we serve as the gateway for Alaska's entire public safety response system. Every emergency response begins with a voice on the phone, someone working to bring order to chaos and guide a person through the worst moment of their life. HB 234 recognizes that voice is truly a first responder. I want to thank you guys for your consideration. And if you have any other questions about the trauma, the toll, career terms, I certainly do my best to answer those.
Thank you very much for your testimony and all the work that you and our other invited testimony providers do day to day. Coach Hemshoot.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you so much for your work, Mr. Leslie, I think it was. I did a quick calculation. If I understood correctly, there are 372,000 annual 911 calls in Anchorage, and that works out to 1,019 calls every day. So that seems like such an extreme number. How many of you are on shift at any given time, and how many total? So you are with the police department, and then we have a whole separate department. So maybe I'm talking about the other department. I'm talking about firefighters. So what does it look like? Yeah, what's the volume look like for you? How many folks work in your...
Oh, we're losing your connection a little bit.
Yeah, so to provide a little bit of context that... to provide a little context and structure, Stephanie Wolf spoke a little bit about the 22 different PSAPs, public safety access points, that the state of Alaska has. Anchorage Police Department is the one that houses the PSAP for the municipality of Anchorage. So if you are within the geographic constraints of the municipality, and you dial 911, it will go to the police department first. We do the initial triage for every 911 that comes into the city. Our call volume, if we calculate both our 911 and our non-emergency calls, because while people tend to use 911 for emergencies, it is not uncommon for us to receive a shooting or a stabbing on the non-emergency line as well. We receive well over 400,000 calls a year within our center alone, combining both the emergency and the non-emergency response. So every day, as your quick calculation was, we are well north of 1,500 calls that come through our center every 24-hour period. Our maximum staffing level right now is a total of 11 bodies. Four of those individuals do not answer the phone. So the maximum number for that at any one time that someone will answer a phone is seven bodies for those phone calls. We will do the initial triage. If it is a strict fire EMS response, we will pass it off to our counterparts at AFD. If it is a co-response where there is a component of public safety that is still there, we will maintain the call and we will have a coworker contact AFD for them to gear up their response as per protocol, or if it is primarily a life-saving type call where there isn't a component for public safety, we'll transfer the call to AFD for them to do their initial triage and response.
Okay, thanks. I have other questions, but they're for the bill sponsor. Appreciate your quick facts. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, is the Anchorage Dispatch Department working, I think the number is 811, but the crisis now, in Fairbanks they have crisis now somehow is interfacing with the regular dispatch, 911 dispatch. Is that the same in Anchorage or is that a separate issue?
There's a similar operational overlap as Fairbanks has. If someone calls in to either the non-emergency or the 911 line, and as long as it meets specific criteria where we know that based on the information we're receiving, that that person is not a threat to others around them, and we know that they have not taken a drastic step towards self-harm for themselves, and they don't have a firearm or they don't have a gun or they don't have some other form of violent lethal means, then we will pass them off to the care line for the care line to help with that response.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Follow up? Are you good?
That the care line, that is that a separate consideration for purposes of this bill?
That would be separate consideration, yes.
Separate. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And through the chair, to kind of, I have some of the same questions as far as like how many people would qualify for this and the fiscal note. And I think this will provide a little more clarity, at least in this initial hearing. Mr. Lasley, did I pronounce that correct? Perfect.
Yes, sir.
You had mentioned that since 1990, fewer than five have served, and it was 25 or 30 years?
30 years based on the way that Tier 3 is currently structured. For a non-sworn employee or that classification of all others outside of police and fire, for a full retirement, we are required to do 30 years.
Follow up. So since 1990, you said fewer than five. How many has it been? Do you have an actual number? Is it one or is it four?
Me going through looking at our staffing notes and trying to pick the brains of those that have been here longer than myself, I believe we came up with three individuals that have hit the full 30.
Thank you. Are there further questions for Mr. Lasley? Then we will move on to our final invited testimony. We have Shane Westcott. He is the South Central Vice President for the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association. Welcome to House Community and Regional Affairs. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, everybody. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
All right. Awesome. Like I was introduced by the co-chair, Representative Mears there. My name is Shane Westcott, and I'm with the Alaska Professional Firefighters. Today I just kind of wanted to hammer a few points that I think had already been touched on, but really emphasize, like, what's bringing on this transition. And I don't think it can be emphasized enough that when this position of a dispatcher, now being moved in a definition of a telecommunicator going forward is the change that they went through. When you go from just being a body that answers the phone or gives the directions to performing those life-saving capabilities, there's been a drastic change, and this is an opportunity to recognize that change. By moving them over into a public safety category, like we're talking about here, giving them access to federal money for grants for extra training to make sure that they are better at their jobs and they can, you know, be the most up to date they can possibly be, I think is crucial for these guys. When they go and get their EMT 1 certification or they go get these extra certifications, a lot of that's on their own time. And so, by making this transition, I think we're allowing ourselves to have more qualified, better trained individuals in these positions. One of the other things that was brought up today was talking about the number of Tier 3 employees that are going to be, you know, potentially would be transitioning here. And I don't have numbers for across the state, but I did want to talk about, and specifically for the Anchorage Fire Department dispatch, we currently only have 5 Tier 3 members out of roughly a group of 40 dispatchers. And I believe on the police side, they have about 12 members and a group of about 60 dispatchers. And I think you'll probably see, you know, similar correlation in numbers across most dispatching departments within the state. And one thing that I also wanted to say to you guys, too, is that, because I think these dispatchers are probably being too nice when they're using the word script here. And I want to really emphasize what these individuals are doing on a day-to-day basis. They don't answer the phone and, you know, read from a piece of paper to give directions or something like that. These guys are answering phone calls from people who are going through essentially the worst moments in their life, and they have no one else to call. And these individuals have to be able to, in a calm, cool, collective manner, identify the, you know, actual problem at hand, get critical information, and then start the process to, you know, start these life-saving measures. And having sat in the dispatch center and watched these guys take these calls and, you know, work through these problems and actually come up with quality information so that people like Matt or people like APD officers or Alaska State Troopers and so on and so forth across the state can get to where they need to do and get the right resources there, it's beyond impressive. And if you haven't seen it, by all means, swing on by. These guys would love to show you what they do. The last thing I did want to clarify, too, is there was a question about, you know, what qualifies for public safety and do paramedics qualify for something like that. It just really depends on if it's through a private or municipal, when that is a municipal employee, kind of like the gentleman from the Division of Retirement and Benefits is talking about. If it's through a municipality, so for example, in Anchorage, all paramedics or firefighters and so on and so forth, they fall under this rule. Whereas if you work for a private company, just as an EMS provider, you may not. So, like I said, at the end of the day, I think this bill here is essentially just righting a wrong. And the wrong just being that at the time when these positions were created, the job was just very different. And this is now an opportunity to make sure that these individuals who are the first responders, as they've said, are represented appropriately and that they are public safety. If there's questions that I can answer, I'm happy to answer those, and I appreciate you guys taking the time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Westcott. Do we have any questions for Mr. Westcott? Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I think I have the right person for this. We've heard from Anchorage, nothing against Anchorage, but is there an organization that talks to other municipalities around the state? I'm trying to figure out if it's sort of uniform around the state or if we have to talk to other municipalities, et cetera.
Through the chair, I just want to make sure I understand the question. Is the question like, did this just originate in Anchorage, or is this a statewide issue? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, that's more or less what I'm trying to determine. Yep.
Yeah, so, you know, federally for about the last 4 or 5 years here, there's been work on a national level in a larger scale to correct this. And as I mentioned earlier, the dispatcher Stephanie talked about how 25 plus states have made a change to this because they've recognized this as a problem. I believe through the community of dispatchers here in the state of Alaska, they have all acknowledged that this is a change that needs to happen. And the group that Stephanie was mentioning that she's a part of, and I believe that Dennis mentioned that they were a part of as well, is a statewide group of dispatchers that are looking to make this change. Yes, this isn't just an Anchorage issue. This is a statewide issue. This deals with MATCOM. This deals with the Alaska State Troopers. This deals with rural communities. This deals with everybody, especially up in Fairbanks as well.
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. Thank you.
Thank you. Coach Hemshoot.
My question, I think, would go to the bill sponsor, but might be answered by folks online. So maybe I start there. Okay, great. Through the co-chair to the bill sponsor, I'm wondering if you have input from other communities. It's been very Anchorage-centric today. So this is a problem statewide, and I can speak a whole lot to the problem in my communities. One question I have is it excludes VPSOs specifically. What's the reasoning behind that?
Representative Hemshoot, through the co-chair, Carolyn Hall, for the record, I do not know the answer to that question. I'm very happy to find the answer for you and bring it back before the committee. Referencing the geographic nature of our invited testifiers, we have been in touch with dispatchers from, I believe, Sterling and Soldotna, but I want to punt it over to my staff who can share more information.
Yeah, through the chair to Chair Hemshoot. We do have support from various members from across the state. I'm still gathering letters of support. Some came in after the deadline for turning this in, and we have a letter currently in the record from Soldotna. I also have received letters of support, I believe, and you can not just for this, but also lots of letters for HJR 38, which is the federal our bill that addresses this at the federal level, which has truly like statewide recognition, so letters of support in. On sort of these same ideas from, Valdez, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Mat-Su, Juneau. We were unfortunately unable to get Aaron in today, but we are expecting to have the Juneau Police Department here to testify when public testimony opens. So we do have letters of support and support from our communities across the state.
I would strongly encourage you to reach out to communities not on the road system and smaller than 30,000 people. So,
thank you.
One thing I would say is the VPSOs are in a partnership, so I could see that there might not be a state role there, but I would really like to have an answer to that question. I was wondering if you've reached out to AML. They sometimes can help with those smaller communities who are less than 30,000 and not on the road system. Have you had any conversations with AML? Like, I think we need solutions to this situation everywhere, and so this is a really good start, but this is a law for the entire state. So what is the impact across the state? So have you reached out to AML? And then my second question is, are there statewide standards that we're talking about here? So can this become a statewide solution? And I want to illustrate the issue in my community. We cannot keep a dispatcher. Mm-hmm. We cannot even keep a dispatcher, not even a year. And so if this would help us do that, I'm all in favor. But I need a little more evidence that this bill is going to work in other places. And then just for your awareness, maybe you know this already, but we often will contract. Whittier actually contracts their dispatch service to Sitka. And then Sitka can't keep dispatchers. And we don't have a fire department dispatch service and a police department dispatch service. We share those duties in one individual, and we can't even keep those people. So if this is a solution there, that'd be great. So have you had conversations with AML, and are there statewide standards that apply to dispatchers?
Yeah. To Chair Hemshoot, through the chair, I have not had conversations with AML, but I will be sure to following this meeting. And I believe part of the purpose of this bill is to offer these benefits in hopes that we can retain and keep those dispatchers in our positions where we are seeing high turnover rates because of what the job demands.
Right. And so a concern through the co-chair remains, you know, I hear all of this great training that's happening in Anchorage, and at that call volume, I'm trying to think how you're doing it with seven people, and it just is really impressive, frankly. But then I think about our dispatch office in Sitka, where they're doing police and fire in one individual. who is not there long enough to get the training and the proficiency that you're, you know, 3 years to advance and all of that. So I'm a little concerned that you have different levels of different standards, different requirements for the position in different places, but that doesn't mean that this bill couldn't be a solution or a partial solution to some of those questions. But I would like to see the bill, or at least the sponsor, reaching out to things outside of Anchorage because it is a statewide measure. Thank you.
And I'd like to note that if anyone is listening in, you don't just have to hit our window when we've got public testimony, but you can send an email at any time to hcra@akleg.gov, and that will put you on the record, written testimony to the committee for House Bill 234. Question from Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's more of a statement with a question at the end. Representative Hall and I had a conversation earlier, and it delves into what Representative Hemshoot said in reference to numbers. There's no fiscal note with this, but we know that even if, you know, five people, one person, whatever, there's going to be a fiscal note if they retire under the PERS system. So the fiscal note's concerned, the number of people, and again, Representative Hall and I spoke about that. And the numbers, and I don't have an issue with this bill per se, but I guess the question I would ask is comparing police officers and firefighters in a danger level, how do dispatchers fit into that same category?
Representative St. Clair, through the co-chair, am I understanding your question correctly? Are you comparing the work that an emergency response dispatcher does in the dispatcher center in the dispatch center to, let's say, a police officer who's in a violent altercation with an Alaskan?
Follow up. Through the chair, that's kind of what I'm talking about, danger level, and we're putting dispatchers, who are great people. I know dispatchers. I've worked with dispatchers. I was a quasi-dispatcher in the military. But to put them, my question is, why are we putting dispatchers at the same level as a police officer that, like you said, could be involved in a violent altercation or shooting, etc., and a firefighter that's responding to a fire? It just seems like the danger levels are a little bit different, and that we're really not comparing apples to apples. We're more apples to oranges, whereas the oranges, the threat to life and safety of the individual is not at the same level.
So, Representative St. Clair, I think this is just a piece of a compensation package, and that is addressed in other places in compensation package support and training. But I don't know if Representative Hall has additional things she wants to add to that.
I would actually like to go to one of our invited testifiers, perhaps Mr. Westcott, if he's available to help answer Representative St. Clair's question, since he has lived experience and I do not.
Thank you. Mr. Westcott?
Yeah, I'm here. I guess my question, I want to clarify to the chair that Representative St. Clair, are we asking about the, you know, do they qualify as public safety in the sense of, you know, are they getting shot at or run into a burning building? Was that the question?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Yeah, I think I think the best way to look at this right now is, you know, we've learned a lot in the last 50 years about what it means to be in public safety and what that does, what that can do to an individual. And the people that get involved in public safety, you know, they don't get involved for the money. They don't get involved for, you know, all the glory and everything else. They're doing it to, you know, better the community and to give back. And, you know, one of the things that this state has recognized, is that PTSD is a real thing. You know, I am not a dispatcher. I don't have to take the screaming phone calls, but I know the dispatchers that do. And I think for these individuals to work through those processes and to work through those complex calls and to live with those calls. It's very, very, very similar to what you're doing when you're, you know, dealing with a patient firsthand. And so, yeah, I very much think that this qualifies as public safety. And I very much think that the state has recognized that, that's a side effect of being involved in this. And so, yeah, I firmly believe that this is a public safety position.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wiscott. I think one of the points there is that how long folks are serving in the positions is one of the differences we're looking at here. That's pretty significant for how long you have to work before you're qualified for benefits. Do we have further questions? Representative Holland.
All right. Thank you, through the chair. I have a couple items I wanted to follow up on. First off, I'll just kind of note that the previous questions about the VPSO and why they're being specifically excluded is something that also caught my attention. And we can follow up on that later, but I'm really anxious to kind of understand the scope of what's happening with excluding them. The second question, I think, dovetails with, again, a previous question, but I want to touch on it in a with a little more detail, and that is, I'm curious about the way in which some departments are contracting with other departments for dispatch services. As was noted earlier, Whittier was contracting with, I believe, Sitka, and now has shifted that over to, I believe, Valdez for those services. I also recall last year discussions about, I believe, Wasilla was assisting the state troopers, I think, with dispatch in the Mat-Su Valley. So I'm curious a little bit about the structure of dispatch services, both direct, as we heard primarily today, in terms of the Anchorage dispatching to Anchorage departments, but there's this new layer of contracted dispatching, and I don't know whether or not that dispatching is always being done within the definition here of a dispatcher in a police or fire department, or if we have other departments that are not a police or fire that are providing these contract services. So I'm going to be interested in understanding a little broader scope of who it is that's doing dispatching, and are they being completely captured by this police fire department language that's in here? Are there other dispatch structures in there? The two other areas I wanted to get into that I don't think have come up yet is I wanted to ask the bill sponsor through the chair to just help me understand a little more. In Section 1, we're focused in on emergency medical dispatchers and, you know, I think providing some new language about them being initial first responders. And yet, in the discussion we've had so far, as I understand it, dispatchers are doing a wide range of dispatch triage that might be medical, but in many cases could be an earthquake, could be a traffic accident, could be an intruder. I believe it was mentioned in the testimony from, Ms. Wolf, that there were 22 points, and the bees began rattling or listing through a wide number of different kinds of things. So I'm curious about the bill, why the focus on emergency medical dispatchers, and yet in Section 2, I think dispatchers here are more generic. So I'm just looking for clarification on, is this focused in on just medical, which began the conversation, or is this medical cleanup going on in Section 1, just a unique little bit of cleanup, but we really are intending to talk about all dispatchers, not just medical?
Thank you, Representative Hall.
Thank you, Representative Holland. Through the co-chair, Representative Holland, and for the record, this is Carolyn Hall, HE16. The intention of this bill, when it comes to emergency response dispatchers, is for those who are assisting in emergency response situations. The word medical in Section 1, I can't speak to why it says medical instead of emergency response, but obviously based on the invited testimony that we've heard today and in supporting documents that are forthcoming, these emergency response dispatchers do a variety of have a variety of responses based on the call that they receive. Some of it is medical in nature, but obviously some are not. It just depends on the call. So I'm not really, I think, answering your question satisfactorily, but I'm very happy to follow up on, as far as the word choice specifically, on page 1, line 6, the word medical.
Great, thank you. And then one more follow-up, if I can.
Thank you, Representative Holland.
Through the chair, going in a completely different area, and I think touching on some of the earlier questions about the fiscal note, I'm curious through the chair what the approach is for those individuals who are on Tier 3 that would still be retiring in the next 4 years, I believe. Are they going to be, if this were to pass, will they be receiving the new benefits, and how is that being paid for? Because I'm assuming there's going to be 25-ish years of work that was contributed at one level, but they would suddenly be receiving benefits at a new level, both in terms of the 3-year calculation versus the 5-year calculation, but also I think the difference in contributions made over the years. It seems like there's a fiscal cost. Maybe it ties into we need to figure out how many people are in there. But I'm curious, is the intent, if this were to pass, that those folks would immediately get a big step change in their benefits that are available when they retire at this point, and how's that getting paid for?
Thank you, Representative Holland. Through the co-chair, Representative Holland, my understanding is that the employee contributions would change. But I also would like to call in a lifeline from invited testifier, Mr. Westcott, who can provide more detail.
Thank you, Mr. Westcott.
Hi, thanks again, guys. Yeah, so the way this would work is if there did end up looking like there was going to be a fiscal cost, obviously, we would see that later down the road. But there, in the past, when people have transitioned from a 25-year PERS to a 30-year PERS to a 25-year PERS, it's depending on what the actual cost is, which we would find out in the fiscal note. In the past, either depending on the quality of individuals, there's typically they have the choice to stay in that 30 years and continue on, or they could pay whatever the lump sum cost to that transition into the 25 years would be. There's also been cases where depending on how many people were involved, where the state has also kind of waived that cost based off of the individuals that were allowed. We wouldn't really know, though, until it went through Division of Retirement and Benefits and there's a fiscal note actually added, what that number would actually be.
Good for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then just a note, we do have Mr. Roomsburg from DRB on the line as well if you've got a specific question.
That's a good start for the day.
We'll follow up later with that. Are there further questions from the committee? I also never mind. So it looks like we're questioned out for today, but there will likely be follow-up as we move forward in the bill process. So with no further questions from the committee at the moment, thank you, Representative Hall.
Thank you.
And staff. And with that, we'll set the bill aside for a later day. Thank you for everyone that called in to provide testimony and answer questions for us today. Representative Prox?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Should we focus on HJR 38 at the same time, or is that I'm kind of doubtful that we can get through this bill in the remaining time this session, but should we take a look at HJR 38, and can that be
Representative
just in
Hall,
terms
is
of
that,
the whole process?
Is that, I don't believe that's with us, is it?
Representative Prox, through the co-chair, no, HJR 38 is in Labor and Commerce right now, and its second hearing is scheduled for tomorrow afternoon.
Oh, okay, so that's moving through the process. Very good. Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time in answering that question. So we've got another committee member up for a bill presentation. Last we've heard from Representative Nelson on House Bill 309. Welcome to the presenter's table. Please put yourself on the record and proceed with your bill presentation.
All right. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the Chair, I'm Representative Garrett Nelson from District 29, and today I would like to introduce House Bill 309. In short, this bill before you today is a simple boundary fix to a piece of legislation that was passed in 2018 regarding the Jonesville Public Use Area, which was HB 6. This is an area encompassed by the Matanuska Valley Moose Range on the old site of the Jonesville Coal Mine and affectionately called the Coal Hills by locals. As laid out in the original 2018 bill, which was championed by former representative for District 9 and District 29 and now senator from District O, this specific area sees incredible use for many purposes, from moose hunting to camping, snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, off-roading, and many activities that make Alaska such a wonderful place. It's so beautiful and unique in the Anchorage-Matsu area that it draws over 40% of its annual traffic from Anchorage proper. And we have an annual garbage cleanup organized by different outdoor and off-roading organizations, and we consistently haul off 3 to 5 roll-off dumpsters and many truckloads of burned out and shot up vehicles, typically both burned out and shot up. So, recognizing the draw of the area and the need for management, the borough and the state entered into a management agreement in 2018 after a decade of work, and the result is HB 6 from 2018. So, the bill before you today, it addresses a simple oversight that wasn't recognized until recently. And while property and survey lines make clean, straight paths on a map, we know the realities of topography often complicate those and cause mistakes and give rise to oversights. And that's what this bill addresses. There is a small quarter section of land that was left out of the original bill that was always intended to be part of the public use area. So the sectional analysis, which we'll go over, is very short and simple compared to others, but it adds the necessary boundary adjustment language to complete the original vision of HB 6. And in simple words, there are two roads to enter the Jonesville Public Use Area above and below Slipper Lake. They're both used heavily and many times, and I've done it myself. We go on one road and you come out the other. The proposed management plan from the Matsu Borough incorporates both roads and the common use parking and camping area into their plan. However, the lower road and a significant portion of that common parking area and camping area was accidentally left out. So adding this language to the original bill makes the ongoing management plan that is currently being implemented complete and doable. So in closing, thank you for your consideration. I'm going to turn it over to Catherine Covey from my office for the sectional, and we look forward to answering any questions.
Thank you. Before we go to the sectional, I'd like to note for committee members that there were maps distributed as part of your packets and are available on BASIS. Please proceed with the sectional.
Thank you. Co-chairs, committee members, for the record, my name is Catherine Covey. I'm staff with Representative Garrett Nelson. Section 1 amends AS 4123286, Jonesville Public Use Area. Section 1 updates the statutory boundary description of the Jonesville Public Use Area. Section 2 provides for an immediate effective date under AS 0110070C.
Thank you very much. So before we get to questions from the committee, I'd like to note that we do have a couple other folks online that can help with questions. We have Rachel Longacre. She's the Chief of Operations, Division of Mining, Land, and Water with the Department of Natural Resources, as well as Jillian Morrissey, the Community Development Director for the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. So do we have some questions from the committee to kick us off here? Are you all questions out? No. Representative Holland.
Great, thanks. I had two questions. And I appreciate knowing we've got some folks online might be able to help, but I'll direct these to the bill sponsor initially. And I'm just looking at the map now. Perhaps you could explain on the map the property that's being added. And in particular, what I'm concerned about is, are there adjacent landowners or landholders or who has the land that's adjacent to what's being added? And I'm particularly concerned, have they been notified? Are they involved? Is there any impact on those folks that are going to find this property added to just know that they've been consulted and support this?
Yes, thank you, Madam. Or through the co-chair to Representative Holland. Yes, there have been multiple hearings. I think we've had three in the last 6 months with the borough and concerned property members or people that would be adjacent. And with the risk of raising the ire, I'm going to use a prop, if I may.
Representative Nelson, the rules are different in committee than they are on the floor.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
You may also refer to Senator Rauscher by his full name.
Okay.
Title.
Yes. Senator Rauscher is the one who did the work. Perfect. So we have a couple of printouts here, and there were a multitude of maps with the original bill. And some of them were a little confusing. But the area in question, if there's the one, if you guys can pull up the page right here, it's Section 21. And all that Section 21 adds is it's literally a quarter of that square, which is all owned by the state. And just to make clear, too, this is not a land swap or a land transfer. It's just the state giving the borough management over this public use area. And so in Section 21 on the map, you can see they would just give basically essentially a quarter. And I was going to, oh, look at this. We're going to pull it up. Yeah, science, technology. And then I'll run the mouse, and it'll make it clear, Representative Holland. Sorry. I was ready with physical stuff.
Before we do that, Co-Chair Mears, can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
So public use area. So this is DNR land, state land.
Yes, ma'am.
And what are the protections of a public use area? I'm sorry. I'm sure this was in 2018. But what is a public use area?
There's a hierarchy, but I would like, if possible, to defer to Rachel for that one.
Online. Thank you. Ms. Longacre, can you answer that question for Co-Chair Hemchut?
Yes, good morning. Through the chair, I hope you guys can hear me.
Yes.
For the record, my name is Rachel Longacre. I am the Chief of Operations here at the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Representative Holland, I believe, asked that question, if I'm correct. Each public use area is going to have a different set of definitions or designations. Jonesville is very similar to our Kinnick River area public use area. Essentially, what you can think of it is kind of like a wedding cake. We have general state land that has regulations, statutes that guide it, but a special use area is going to have a layer on top of that, and that's what's within these boundaries. There's quite a list underneath the public use area code that's specific to Jonesville. We are in the process of developing regulations to allow DNR to enforce certain aspects of that public use area. And if I may, earlier there was a question about the amount of acreage for these areas. Section 21 provides approximately 80 acres to be added to the public use area. That is the green area on the map. And in Section 15, higher on the map, that adds or removes approximately 40 acres, which is the orange area on the map.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, we've got our maps up. You want to do a little mouse drive in there and explain things a little bit better to us?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And so you're going to have to turn your head sideways because we can't rotate this picture. But essentially, in this area right here, to address Rep. Holland's question, if you can see that right here, it's going to take this property line, straight line through here on the green section in Section 21, and that's it. That section is all that's being added. And in reference, this is from Google Maps. So you can see this area right here is represented by this area. So half of it is included in the bill that was previously passed 8 years ago. And this red line is the road. So this is the entire, this area right here is kind of the bread and butter of where people actually spend their time and recreate. So all we're doing is we're taking the property line, which actually currently goes through here on the Google Maps picture, and just bringing it down that quarter of a section to include the entire Some people call it the airport, but basically the area around Slipper Lake.
So since we do not have a north orientation on the map, I'm assuming that north is to the left side of the map here.
North would be to the right side.
North to the right.
To me, it's on the right.
I can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I see.
North is over here.
Yeah, it's challenging to see those yellow numbers inside of the black.
Yes.
Okay. So you're pulling the property line south to me.
Essentially, yes. And in the sectional that Catherine read on line 24, page 2, adjusting that boundary language, which was established in 2018, adding line 24, which would be section 21, adds this quarter section right here.
To quarter section, okay.
It adds that quarter section right there.
Follow up?
Thank you. Representative Holland?
Okay, thank you. So I was getting back to trying to understand what's going on the adjacent property, and is anybody affected by these two transactions in terms of people that are next to this that would have concerns about the addition or the removal? It looks empty, but I'm just trying to figure out if there's somebody there.
Yeah, I mean, to be frank, there are some people that had some concerns because the borough, we're talking about putting in a shooting range here, but they're on 17 Mile, which is miles away to the west, and it actually doesn't, this adding this boundary right here doesn't affect any of the concerned property owners and actually doesn't change the project. But there are people that did raise some concern through public testimony in the meetings that we had.
Follow-up?
Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you for that. And can you clarify why the property in Section 15 is being removed from the boundary? What's happening there that would cause us to take that out of the special use area, as I understand the action here?
I'm going to refer to, if possible, I'm going to punt to the representative for the borough on that one.
Thank you, Jillian Morrissey. Please put yourself on the record, and if you can answer Representative Holland's question.
Good morning. This is Jillian Morrissey. I'm the Community Development Director for the Matthew Borough. And through the chair, I want to thank you for the question. One of the things with this adjustment of the Jonesville Public Youth Area boundary, we are the Matthew Borough is no longer operating the area that's being removed as a recreation area, so we're supportive of this adjustment of the boundary. And through our public process, we've just had 3 open houses and public meetings with the community at Alt and Sutton. These proposed changes with the boundary alignment would allow would better support our conceptual design direction that has emerged through those planning processes. And aligning the public use boundary with the recommendations that are in this bill provides much better clarity for our long-term planning and land management and operations and meets the public expectations.
Thank you, and I appreciate you answering that, providing that additional information on community outreach and participation. Representative Holland?
Yeah, final follow-up. And to the sponsor, or this could go to the Matsu Borough, do we have a specific action by the borough or other local jurisdiction asking us to do this?
Representative Nelson?
Yes, through the co-chair to Rep. Holland. The answer is yes, but I will once again defer for more detailed follow-up to the borough, but the answer is yes.
Thank you. Ms. Morrissey?
And I'm sorry, could the question be asked again?
Representative Holland.
Sure. Through the chair, I'm just looking for clarification. Has the borough or whatever affected local jurisdiction, is there an ordinance, a motion, or a resolution asking us to take this action? I'm just looking for some official action by the local jurisdiction asking us to do this.
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, I apologize. I don't have that answer for you right now. I can look in our historic records and through our process through the Matthew Borough Assembly to provide that at a later time for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm not aware of any actual written request, but this is a project that I've been intimately familiar with before I took this particular role, and I've been in those public hearings. So I don't think that there's a written request, but it is something that is clearly recognized that needed to be fixed, and so we just brought it forward.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, could you point out to us the area that we're looking, the other area that we're looking at changing a boundary?
Yeah. Let me pull up the other map. Let me see here. It's in 15. So hang on a sec. The square is up. I got to pull up the old map here. No, that picture will still work.
Right.
Yep. So the area that we're, the other area in 15, once again, sorry, we turned our head sideways. I had the same problem with Adobe yesterday that I had to rectify so that I could print off my prop. But the other area in area 15 is right in this section here. And so essentially what it would do is it's going to remove this portion right here. So it just clarifies that boundary as well. This square right here. And you can see that on the supporting docs, the under the map label, or the pink lettering is Jonesville PUA, Public Use Area Boundary.
Thank you, Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. That, through the chair, that introduces a new question. And while you've got that pointer right where you've got it right now, it appears from this map that there is a set of trails that comes from the end of a road at what I think would be the southwest corner that then moves to the northeast. If you remove this section from the public use area, it appears that you might be removing the connection to a number of trails that exist to what I believe is the north. And that concerns me that this might create a problem for the public use area if that land is no longer in the public use area, yet it appears to be an essential connection route for all of those trails. So I'm back to my earlier question of why are we taking this out? And if we are, what's going to, what will the plan be to maintain the connection to the trail system I see to the north?
Through the chair to Rep. Holland, I will say from practical experience that the trails are not precluded from enjoyment, but I will defer to Rachel if she's on the line still to answer that.
Ms. Longacre?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Holland, Rachel Longacre for the record here. If that boundary does remove that acreage, those trails would then exist under general state land authority. They would still continue to exist and be utilized. They just wouldn't be included in the Jonesville public use area. Let me clarify too, the public use area is not just opening it for public use. All general state land is for public use. This public use area allows a special layer to be added to help protect some of those activities, such as, using the trees in that area for personal use, or utilizing the trail, or even hunting and fishing. This is a moose range as well, another layer. So those trails will continue to exist. They'll be just under a different set of authority.
Thank you, Representative Holland.
Yep, thank you. I'll just leave it as a comment for the moment. I'd like to follow up with the bill sponsor later, but right at the moment I don't understand why this piece of property is being removed. So I'd love to follow up and get a better understanding of that. And at the end of the day, I really want to defer to the local authority. I have a really cautious concern about us and the legislature doing things that affect local folks. So I'm really looking for very explicit, clear understanding about local people that are impacted if we're going to make this decision, and local authorities that are really in control of this sort of thing. So I have a strong deference to wanting to see really clear, explicit direction from the local authority.
Thank you. Perhaps Ms. Morrissey, do you have more that you can share with us about supporting removal of that area from the Jonesville area?
Through the chair to Representative Holland, thank you very much for the question. And we appreciate the sentiment that you are reflecting here. What I will say is that that area will still be under our land use of generally allowed uses. We very much support making sure that the NAPSU is the best place to live, work, and play. And so we will continue to work with DNR and Alaska Fish and Game in order to support recreation in this area. And we have entered a management agreement with DNR and Alaska Fish and Game to help continue to support more recreational opportunities, particularly in the Jonesville public use area.
Thank you, Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the chair, I think my question is to Ms. Longacre, and I want to echo what Representative Holland said. A resolution from the local governing body would go a long way in clarifying why this is needed and that it has local support, because often land use things come federally, at least, and I live in an area of great federal ownership, I guess. There's a public comment period, and people can register their complaints and their concerns and their support. And so it would be helpful, absent that, having local input. But my question for Ms. Longacre is, with the layer cake thing, what will people not be able to do if that section is removed in Area 15? When we take that out of the public use area, what impact does that have on the ability of folks to use this area?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, Rachel Longacre for the record, I would need to follow up with the committee and provide exact details. I'd be uncomfortable speaking to the list of items that could or couldn't be impacted.
Thank you.
Follow up. Yeah, thank you. So that would be helpful. And then if we're going to talk about what removal means, then also addition for that other section that's going to be added. It's interesting on the, I'm going to call it aerial photo. It's quite the area has an airstrip and looks like maybe it was once a mine or something. And so I'm guessing maybe there's like really fun features for ATV in the summer and snow machines in the winter and a place for target practice and that kind of thing. So I could see the utility of this area. And so the area that's being added, what will that allow people to do that they can't currently do? So if that could be really clearly spelled out. I understand this was an error when they went through the process in 2018. And I don't want to have to go through such an exhaustive process again, but I need to understand what are we adding that people can do and taking away that people can no longer do in those two areas.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, thank you. Through the Co-Chair, to the Co-Chair, I will provide that information. There's a plethora of information. We've had a tremendous amount of public testimony, and I'll provide that both offline and on the record to clarify those questions. Because once you know the area, it's incredibly clear why this quarter section needs to be added. And I will provide that, and I'll do it for the record as well.
Madam Co-Chair, I suggest a field trip for the committee.
That will make it even more clear. I'm sorry, through the Co-Chair. Yes.
I appreciate that thought. Unfortunately, we don't have a committee budget to do such a thing. So are there further questions? Representative Prox?
Yes. Thank you. Through the Chair, I believe it's Section 22 that is right oriented. Below, I guess we'll call it on the map. Mm-hmm. That looks like a residential subdivision almost, fairly densely populated. Are they happy with this?
Yes, through the co-chair, Garrett Nelson, once again. Yes, they call those subdivisions, and those are just property lines. So the property lines do not accurately reflect the population. That being said, the people that live in the area and have been involved in this for the past decade and a half, the people that are the most impacted, that live the closest, are in the, highest category of favor for more borough management, both for trash cleanup, for shooting, for ATV management, things of that nature. So the people that live right next to it are the ones that are the most vocal advocates for this moving forward with the borough.
Okay, so as we're getting ready to wrap up here, I do want to note again, if folks want to provide written testimony to the committee, that is hcra@akleg.gov to send an email, and it will be on the record for House Bill 309. So I need to wrap us up here today. We will set this bill aside for a later consideration. So that will conclude our business for today. We do have amendment deadlines, two of them, HB 286 for Tuesday, March 17th at 5 p.m., and also 282 automated traffic safety cameras, which we had heard earlier, that is sponsored by Representative Fields, and that will be for tomorrow, March 13th at 5 p.m. If you need more time for either of those bills, please reach out to our offices. We are all in the process of setting next week's schedule, so we'll share that via email, but I'd like to note that we will have regular committee times both Tuesday and Thursday for the first time this session. In parentheses, I believe. So. So seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 9:58 a.m.